welcome to Real Britannia. Today's date is Monday the 16th of January 2023, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. It's only the beginning of the year, but we have lots and lots of exciting news stories to get into that will be of interest to British nationalists, and who better to discuss them with than Max Musson from Western Spring. Max, good day, sir. How is life treating you?
Yeah, life is pretty good at the moment. I can't complain. I'm looking forward to getting into the new year and putting the festive period behind us. You were talking about the sort of exciting stories, and I'm looking forward to getting spare behind us as well, because I think that some of our listeners might have worried that we were going to spend a bit of time talking about that book, but we're not. We're going to completely ignore that book and look at other more important things.
Yeah, I completely forgotten about that. Of course, yeah, Prince Harry's book, his scandalous book where he just rubbishes his entire family and rubbishes his entire reputation. I'll just bring up one point from it. He said about him shooting and killing these 25 Taliban or something like that. And then the BBC were reporting it, the Taliban insulting him or something. But one thing the Taliban did say was they did say that it was very courageous of him to actually admit that, which the BBC weren't actually reporting on. But yes, we're not going to talk about Prince Harry. We have plenty of other news stories to get into. And the first one is this news story concerning Andrew Bridgen, the former Conservative MP. And I think everybody was really surprised at this. And we have to say that he's very, very brave and courageous to do this. He stood up in the Houses of Parliament and he highlighted all the deaths and all the unexpected circumstances that have happened with the vaccine, with the COVID vaccine, and the number of people that have been ill after it, and that there's been a huge cover-up for this. And this is the first time that we've had a major mainstream member of parliament doing this and speaking out about this. And you have to say that he's very courageous to do so, because straight away after that, there were these allegations that he had sexually assaulted somebody. And this happened to be somebody that formerly worked for UKIP, and he was out drinking in London, and he went back to his flat with this person that he's alleged to have touched her breast, but there was somebody else there as well. They went back to his flat after drinking at the pub for cigarettes and another drink, I guess. And as I say, he had somebody else there to go out for a cigarette. They walked through his bedroom, and on his bed he had a Union Jack duvet, which he pointed out. They went out for a cigarette. After that, the lady that was there and the other guest that was there, they went home. And apparently when the lady was on her way out, she saw a security guard, and it was this security guard that insisted on phoning the police. I've got a quote here about it. The parliamentary aide and former charity worker Annabel, who has now fled abroad, revealed she never wanted the case against the North West Leicestershire MP to go ahead. She said she didn't even phone the police, claiming it was a security guard working at the MP's block of flats who made the call. And straight away there was this scandal that he had sexually assaulted this woman, and it was probably he just brushed against her or something like that. He really doesn't seem the type to me to be making sexual assaults on people. And it's very, very suspicious that this came out straight away after he exposed the vaccine in the Houses of Parliament. After that, he continued, he doubled down on this, and he quoted this Jewish professor about all of these illnesses that have happened to do with the vaccine. And the quote was saying that this was the worst genocide or the worst crime against humanity since the Holocaust. And it was a Jewish professor that said this, that he was quoting. And because he said this, all of the MPs have accused him of being an anti-Semite, a racist, homophobe, all the phobic words. I mean, all you have to look up is that chap that was on I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. I momentarily forget his name. But if you look up his speech, he calls him all of these names, calls him an anti-Semite. And then you have Rishi Sunak, who steps in there. Anti-Semitism is a terrible blight, and we're all united against fighting against it. And anybody seeing that is just thinking, well, what was anti-Semitic about what he said? I mean, what is anti-Semitic about saying this is a great crime, the greatest crime since the Holocaust? I mean, he's obviously upholding the fact that the Holocaust is the greatest crime ever to befall humanity. And yet they're all saying that he's anti-Semitic. So, of course, what they've done is they've removed the whip from him, which means that he is no longer a Conservative MP. He's an independent MP. And this has still not made him back down. This is why I say you have to give the man credit. He's put out a YouTube explaining his side of the story, saying this is not anti-Semitism. He was not intending on insulting anybody. But this issue has to be spoken about. The fact that these vaccines have had all these unintended consequences. So many people have been ill. There's a very good documentary called Died Suddenly. I'm sure most of our listeners have seen this video, where all these embalmers, people working in funeral directors, have found all of these strange blood clots in the bodies when they're working on these bodies and they're embalming them. Great big long blood clots that look like calamari squid. And of course, if your heart is struggling to pump around these lumps in your body, you're likely to have a heart attack, you're likely to have a stroke. And of course, that's what we've seen from these vaccines. We've seen all these instances of myocarditis. We're starting to see lots of people just collapsing on air, sportsmen collapsing who should be the most fit. And it looks like all of these things are linked to the vaccine. And this Andrew Bridgen has good on him for speaking about this. I think it's fantastic that he's speaking about it. But we can also see instantly the way that the system tries to, first off, they try to slander him, then they take away the fact that he's a part of the Conservative Party. And this is because he's speaking up and he's exposing the corruption that is within the system. So I think we should all be giving Andrew Bridgen our support. I mean, even if you're just retweeting him, just sharing his videos. And I'm just very pleased to see that we do still have some MPs with some backbone. So good on Andrew Bridgen. Have you seen this news story, Max? You got any thoughts on it?
I did see the news story, and I thought it was rather strange, the way the sort of sequence of events surrounding it. I am aware of lots of allegations made by people. I've not seen the results of any scientific inquiries into this, but just from anecdotal information, lots of people have said to me that they know of people who have, or you know, they themselves have suffered all sorts of weird ailments since they had the COVID vaccinations, things like alopecia, things like complications in pregnancy, and strange pains in that with their sort of internal organs and things of this sort. And so, you know, there is some scope to sort of investigate that point of view. And I don't think anybody who suggests that these things should be investigated should actually be pilloried just for doing that. I think that the anti-Semitism side of things comes from the fact that Jewish organizations want to preserve the Holocaust as being the foremost incident of genocide that has ever happened in the entire history of the world. And as a result of that, they are very aggressive whenever anybody tries to compare any other genocide or any other killing or any other phenomenon with the Holocaust. The Holocaust, in their view, has to sit above and apart from all other crimes as being, you know, the biggest crime, as I say, in the history of the world. And so what's happened here is that there's been a kind of a knee-jerk reaction to the fact this guy mentioned the Holocaust and compared the deaths that have occurred as a result of the COVID vaccines with the Holocaust. And they've just, from that, they've said, oh, no, he's not kept the Holocaust completely separate and regarded as completely, immensely worse than anything that's ever happened before. So therefore, that's got to be anti-Semitic. And if you a couple of years or so back, there was this new definition of anti-Semitism that was going around, where there was lots of pressure on governments and organizations to pledge their adherence to this definition of anti-Semitism. And I think that in that definition, there is, if it is not stated explicitly, it's implied, the idea really that the Holocaust has to be regarded as being something which is entirely separate and far worse to an order of magnitude than any other crime or genocide that's ever happened before. And if you don't do that, then that is anti-Semitic. according to, you know, I think that's a part of that, or certainly implied by that new definition of anti-Semitism. And so I think what's happened here is that people who are very sensitive to Jewish issues, including some Jewish organisations themselves, no doubt, have reacted angrily to the fact that this chap has compared deaths due to COVID-19 with the Holocaust.
Yeah, it's like completely regardless of the fact that what he was doing was actually quoting a Jewish professor that said that.
Yeah, yeah. Again, as I say, a strange course of events, really, isn't it? A strange sequence of events.
You know, maybe they would call him a self-hating Jew or something for saying that. But the interesting thing is that it just shows you that when they can't actually come up with a response and they can't come up with an argument, they come up with the name-calling. And that's what they've done. They're trying to call him names and smear his reputation by calling him these names. But I don't think it's working because, as you were saying there, Max, everybody knows somebody that has had some kind of side effect from these vaccines. If you look at the numbers of uptake, I think it was something like 88% took the first vaccine, 70% took the second booster, 60% took the third booster. You know, more and more people are not getting these boosters because they are finding people that have been damaged by these vaccines, far more damaged than they know people that died from the actual disease, COVID-19. So it's very good that Andrew Bridgen is speaking up about this. And as I say, we have to support him. We also had a tragedy that we learned about last week as well, a tragedy of this young girl, Rhiannon Rudd, who was reported for terrorism to prevent by her mother. And she ended up dying. She ended up actually taking her life afterwards. An absolute tragedy. And I had a look at this last week, but I didn't get a chance to actually talk about it in the Daily Nationalist. And I know you've been looking at it, Max, as well. You've been looking at it in quite some detail. So do you want to explain what was going on there with this girl, Rhiannon Rudd, and the backstory to it?
Yeah, what seems to have happened is that Rhiannon Rudd's mother noticed that Rhiannon was talking about what she describes as racist ideas all of a sudden, and the mother was becoming a little bit concerned about that. This was in the early part of 2020, and then one day, according to Rhiannon's mother, Rhiannon came downstairs from having been on the computer at home and said that she just downloaded a PDF, and this PDF contained instructions on how to make a bomb. And Rhiannon's mother sort of reacted very strongly to this and said, "Don't you dare, you know, do anything of the sort." But then referred Rhiannon to Prevent, which is the government's counter extremism organization. Prevent has been established in order to try and sort of intervene where they think that young people are going astray, and to mentor them and guide them back to the straight and narrow, so to speak. What then happened was that around about a month after this referral to Prevent, Rhiannon's mother was contacted and told by a neighbour that there were police swarming around her house. She went back home and found that there were 19 police officers that had been sent to arrest her daughter, who was, I think, 14 at the time, apparently 5 foot tall and weighing only about 7 stone. And so, you know, why would they need 19 police officers in order to arrest such a small person? And Rhiannon was then charged with various terrorism offences, the main one appearing to be the very often used catch-all provision within the Terrorism Act, which is that if you download or if you have on a computer or any electronic device bomb making instructions of any sort, then that is sufficient to get you convicted of a terrorist offence. And the point is that there are a number of these files, that PDF files, that seem to be washing around the internet, and young people being what they are, sometimes young people will just out of curiosity download one of these files, read it, and then probably in most cases just delete it and never think about it again, and certainly never have any intention of actually going off and making a bomb. I don't know what the specifics of the case are with Rhiannon, whether there was anything else that made the situation more more important or dangerous. But the fact of the matter is that the only offence that's actually been noted that she was charged with was the fact that she'd downloaded this file, which she'd told her mother, which her mother had told Prevent in any case. So it wasn't something that anybody needed to really discover. But the upshot of it was that Rhiannon eventually, having been charged with terrorism offences, then had the charges dropped against her towards the end of 2021. And by this time, she had been taken into care. So she was living in a care home. And in May 2022, she sadly committed suicide in her room. There are a number of articles about it. There's a BBC podcast about it, which goes into quite some detail. And there are some quotes made by people who've made themselves quite famous in this particular field. A chap called Nigel Bromage, who is the founder of a charity called Exit Hate, who tries to create the impression, in my opinion, when reading through his material, that it's a very difficult process for anybody to leave any nationalist or right-wing organisations. And the implication always is that there is some danger involved in doing that, and people need to be helped to do it. When in fact, you know, if somebody joins a nationalist organisation and then they decide to leave, they just walk away, and there aren't any sort of implications that follow on from that. But also there's a statement by Nick Lowes, and if I read the Nigel Bromage what has been reported about what he said, and this was reported in the Standard, so we'd have to rely on the Standard as to whether how accurate this is. But it says Nigel Bromage, founder of the charity Exit Hate, which helps to steer people away from extremism, said it had seen a growing number of children falling victim to online grooming by right-wing extremists. And Nick Lowles, director of Hope Not Hate, or chief executive rather of Hope Not Hate, added that to Rudd's story that sadly it's another case of how far-right extremism ruins lives. And so that's a story which is following a kind of a narrative that we've all become fairly familiar with over time. But when you read further into this story, what you find is that Rhiannon Rudd's mother had taken part in a prison pen pal scheme run by the American authorities. And so she had become a pen pal with a convict in an American prison. And then presumably after this chap had been released, he came over to the UK and met up with Rhiannon's mother, and they had some kind of a relationship for a while. It turns out that this chap was a member of one of these right-wing organizations that exists in American prisons, where white prisoners gang together in order to defend themselves from black prisoners who tend to form gangs. That you tend to get gangs forming in American prisons that tend to be racially based. And so anyway, this chap was a member of one of these gangs and he came over and, as I say, apparently had a relationship with Rhiannon's mother, which didn't last very long before he went back over to the USA again. But during the period that he was in the UK, it appears from the reports I've read that he introduced Rhiannon to another convict or another person in America who was a member of a similar kind of right-wing organization. And it appears from the reports that are published over here in the UK that in addition to being groomed into right-wing extremism, in inverted commas, I don't know how extreme that was, Rhiannon was also groomed sexually as well. I don't know actually who by, whether it was one of these first two gentlemen or whether it was somebody else, I don't know, but she was apparently groomed sexually as well. But the impression I get from reading the news reports is that the news organisations and organisations that look into the welfare of children seem to be far more obsessed and far more concerned by the fact that part of Rhiannon's grooming involved what they regard as right-wing extremism, rather than looking at this sexual exploitation of a originally a 14-year-old girl, which I would have thought was a far more serious issue, especially as Rhiannon hadn't actually been involved in any violent terrorism at all. All that she had done was she had downloaded a PDF file, which then meant that technically she had committed a terrorist offence. Even though she apparently had done nothing with the information that she'd received. And I just think it's very sad that the police and the criminal justice system are so obsessed with countering what they see as right-wing extremism that they almost ignore the fact, and there's no comment made in any of the news articles that I've read or in the BBC's podcast. There's no comment saying, and perhaps there ought to be some serious investigation into the sexual grooming of Rhiannon Rudd and the at all. And so Rhiannon Rudd has been introduced to right-wing ideas as a result of her mother taking part in a prison pen pal scheme, and because of that, she's then been taken away from her home, made to live in a care home, and as a result of being living in the care home, presumably having insufficient care taken off her, because you know if sufficient care had been taken off her, then she probably would still be alive. Her mother reported, warning the care home operators that she thought her daughter was in danger of committing suicide, but it appears that whatever action was taken wasn't sufficient to stop her from committing suicide. So it is a really tragic case. But the other issue that it highlights as well is the fact that Rhiannon Rudd's mother was allowed to participate in a prison pen pal scheme without presumably the vulnerability of her and her daughter having been taken into consideration. I would have thought if I was organising a prison pen pal scheme that you know both the prisoners that wanted to take part in the pen pal scheme would have been carefully selected, and anybody who was a bit dodgy or dangerous would have been selected out, and that the people who were going to be making contact and presumably building some kind of correspondence relationship and perhaps a more significant relationship when the prisoner gets out of prison, that those people ought to have undergone some form of selection as well, to select out all the people who are A, vulnerable themselves, or who have living in their immediate household people who are vulnerable to the influence of ex-convicts effectively. And that's it shows a shocking misplacement of priorities on the part of the criminal justice system and the news media reporting on this case.
Well, it's an absolute tragedy. You think this young girl has ended up taking her life. She was just 14 years old when she was put into the system, unfortunately by her mother. Obviously, the mother was concerned and she wanted the daughter to get help, but the daughter wasn't helped, was she? The daughter was then charged. I think six charges, they say, according to these reports here, for basically related to this downloading a document that could be used for terrorist purposes. And I suspect the document was probably the Anarchist's Cookbook. That's still easily available online, and young people that don't know any better are going to download things like that. They're going to be curious, aren't they? They're going to think, well, what are these weapons? What are this bomb making that people can make just out of household appliances? You know, you're going to be interested in that and curious as a child. And that's effectively what happened here. The poor mother must be feeling absolutely dreadful, because if she hadn't have reported the girl to prevent, she would still be here. If she hadn't have started up this relationship with a convict, then the daughter would not have been introduced to this other convict or member of another prison gang that ended up grooming her. And this is something I think that happens quite often. People that don't know anything about nationalism or right-wing ideology, they mix up these prison gangs with nationalist organizations. I think there's a prison gang that's called the Aryan Brotherhood, and people get that mixed up with the Aryan Nations, which is a church, a Christian identity church in America. So, and the two ideologies are very different. I mean, as you pointed out there, Max, when people are in prison, they tend to divide along racial lines, exactly the same as you see in schools. When the schools break for lunchtime, if you've got a multicultural school, the white kids will sit with the white kids and the non-white kids will sit with the non-white kids. And it's the same in a prison. You know, the white convicts end up all joining together with the other white convicts, and the non-white convicts join with the non-white convicts, and they form these gangs. And it's an absolute tragedy that this girl, what happened to her, basically? And I guess they said that because she had this manual, because she had then also expressed white supremacist views, that is what then turned her into a potential terrorist. If she had been an anarchist and she had downloaded the anarchist book cookbook with all these weapons in it, then they would not have prosecuted her for having documents that could be useful to a terrorist, because they would say, well, she's an anarchist, and an anarchist is not a designated terror threat, whereas right-wing extremists are a designated terror threat. I mean, it's crazy the way that this is all turned out, and it's a lot of children that are getting caught up in this. Just a quote here from the BBC article: convictions in the past 2 years include a Cornish boy who led his own online terror cell, aged 14, and a boy from Darlington arrested, aged 13. In the case of another boy, a pre-sentence report from experts said it was likely that he did not see the wider ramifications of his activities, now seamlessly replaced, apparently, by interests such as Dad's Army. And you've got children here that don't know what it is that they're doing, don't know what it is that they're getting involved in. It's just another fad for them. And instead of encouraging them into positive outlets, if they've got right-wing views, what they do is they're taking them into the system and prosecuting them and saying, oh, we've caught another right-wing terrorist. And it's a 14-year-old who has 1488 written on his shed, who has drawn a picture of London in pencil on paper, drawn a picture of London with a nuclear explosion over it. And then they've prosecuted him, saying, well, that shows that he's got violence on his mind. He's drawn a picture there of London being blown up. He's therefore a terrorist threat. And that's literally what they said about this young lad. What they were referring to here is an online terror cell. That's a chat room where there's other youngsters that are not being careful about the language that they're using, that are obviously exaggerating, probably trying to outdo one another with the more offensive things that they're saying. And again, that gets used to say, well, look, they're trying to incite hate. They're trying to encourage terrorism. And it's absolutely tragic that now we end up with somebody dying from this. I mean, there have been older people that die from this. I remember Paul Hickman, he ended up committing suicide after the police were going after him for being a member of National Action, when he had actually left National Action, and yet the police were still going after him, and he ended up committing suicide. I mean, what we can say is that the people that have been looking at this case, they have said that there needs to be a different way of dealing with these children, that instead of prosecuting them, it would be much better to put them on some kind of a course where their social media is watched, where they're not allowed to have contact with certain groups or organisations. And that's the way that things need to be done now. And that is sort of the upshot of this. They're looking at prevent, and they're saying that needs to be set up better. And also there needs to be another avenue that they can use rather than prosecution when they've got youngsters under the age of 16 that have done something like download documents. Of course, if they're actually a credible threat, if they're amassing weapons and there's evidence of them planning to carry out an attack, then obviously they should be prosecuted. But if they're just downloading documents, talking about things, I mean, children are fantasists as well, and they don't really understand the ramifications of their actions when they're that age. It's just tragic that this girl has lost her life, and the poor mother is going to be left with that on her conscience for the rest of her life as well. And the fact that she said to the children's home, you know, my daughter is suicidal, she needs to be checked on, and they didn't check on her. And the next time that they went into her room, they found that she had hung herself. Yeah, it's really tragic. I don't know if you want to add to that, Max, or shall we move on to the next story?
Yeah, let's move on to the next story.
Well, you were bringing up the podcast there and the fact that the BBC have done a podcast on this. The BBC are also doing another podcast, not just one podcast. They're doing a 10-part series of podcasts on Shemima Begum, if you can believe that. Shemima Begum, who left Britain to go and join ISIS, who stitched suicide bomb vests, who married another ISIS member, giving support to them, basically. She's had her citizenship revoked because she also has Bangladeshi citizenship or Bangalore citizenship. She's out there in Syria. At the moment, of course, she wants to come back to Britain because Britain obviously has a better system in place than Syria does, war-torn Syria. And now the BBC have given her a 10-part podcast series. And remember, she is an admitted member of a proscribed organisation. She's an admitted member of a terrorist organisation. And the BBC are going to give her a 10-part podcast series. Can you imagine them giving any time of day to anybody who is an ex-member of National Action? I don't think they would. Perhaps they might if it was somebody that was renouncing National Action. Perhaps they might in that case. And I guess you could say here, well, is she renouncing the Islamic State? I mean, has she publicly renounced that ideology? But then you would say, well, isn't she just doing that because she wants to come back to Britain? How do you know that she is honest in that? But just to contrast that with right-wing extremism and with another outlawed group, I mean, it's just incredible, isn't it, that they're giving her a 10-part series? And they're obviously just giving her a chance to say whatever she wants.
Yeah, I hadn't heard about the 10-part series, but I had noted when I was listening to the BBC's podcast with regard to Rhiannon Rudd that they mentioned there that they actually feature Shemima Begum saying that ISIS ruins people's lives. And it then says that in the case of Shemima Begum, who travelled age 15, the government has argued against claims of trafficking and said that she's a security threat. Her lawyer says that she was trafficked and sexually exploited. Well, the point is what they're effectively doing, because there's a bit more in that as well, but I won't bother reading through the whole lot of it. But what they're effectively doing is positioning the Rhiannon Rudd case in order to cause people to think more sympathetically towards Shemima Begum as a result. And, you know, there are some similarities between the two cases. But I think in the case of Rhiannon Rudd didn't travel to the United States so that she could take part in the sort of white racial uprising that one of the people that she was in correspondence with was advocating. She hadn't actually touched or made or done anything with any lethal equipment or anything of that sort. She had only, from what we can read from the reports, because they don't specify everything about the case, but it appears that the main offence that she had was that she'd downloaded this bomb making PDF, and that's all she'd done. And so that there is a significant difference between Shemima Begum, in my view, and Rhiannon Rudd.
Well, you can see the narrative that the BBC are trying to push with Shemima Begum just by the title of the podcast. It's titled "I'm Not a Monster." And it's basically, it says that it is hosted by journalist Josh Baker, who claims he wants to know the truth about what really happened. So it's a 10-part podcast, so 10 hours there of Shemima Begum trying to convince the British people that she's not a monster, and it's all being sponsored by the BBC. It's just incredible, isn't it, the way that they would do that, when you contrast it with National Action, as if they would put ever give somebody that was formerly a member of National Action a 10-part podcast series. Just
if you compare it with virtually anything else, like if you went to the Scottish National Party and said, would you like to have a 10-part podcast series on the BBC where you can outline all of your ideas? They'd bite your arm off for the opportunity to do that. The Labour Party would do the same. The Conservative Party would do the same. Any organisation that's got any kind of ideology or that's involved in politics or whatever would jump at the chance of having a 10-part podcast series. Any one of those any one of those causes or any one of those organisations could be seen by any rational person as having more importance for the future well-being of the British people than whether or not Shamima Begum is able to reassume British citizenship.
Yeah, it's all just because of her notoriety, isn't it? She's just being rewarded for her notoriety. Here, I have 10 hours to talk about yourself and convince the British people why you should be allowed back into Britain. It's just incredible that they've actually done that. You know, when I first heard about it, I thought, well, that's a joke, isn't it? Somebody's made a joking meme, Shamima Begum to be given a 10-part podcast series. But no, that is actual real news. Well, shall we move into our modern eugenics presentation, Max, do you think?
Yes, okay, that sounds good.
Let's get into that now. And this will probably be our final presentation talking about eugenics. And it's quite timely, in actual fact, because Professor Edward Dutton is writing a book about eugenics at the moment, which I'm looking forward to reading once it is published. And what we're going to talk about today is just modern eugenics. I mean, we've covered the ancient history of it. We've concentrated on the British history of it. And now we'll have a look at what's going on today and what names it comes under. Developments in genetic, genomic, and reproductive technologies at the beginning of the 21st century have raised numerous questions regarding the ethical status of eugenics, effectively creating a resurgence of interest in the subject. Some, such as UC Berkeley sociologist Troy Duster, have argued that modern genetics is a backdoor to eugenics. This view was shared by then White House Assistant Director for Forensic Sciences, Tanya Simoncelli, who stated in a 2003 publication by the Population and Development Program at Hampshire College that advances in pre-implantation genetic diagnosis are moving society towards a new era of eugenics, that unlike the Nazi eugenics, modern eugenics is consumer-driven and market-based, where children are increasingly being regarded as made-to-order consumer products. In a 2006 newspaper article, Richard Dawkins said that discussion regarding eugenics was inhibited by the shadow of Nazi misuse, to the extent that some scientists would not admit that breeding humans for certain abilities is at all possible. He believes that it is not physically different from breeding domestic animals for traits such as speed or herding skill. Dawkins felt that enough time had elapsed to at least ask just what the ethical differences were between breeding for ability versus training athletes or forcing children to take music lessons, although he could think of persuasive reasons to draw the distinction. So it does seem as if people are talking about this now, and they're mainly talking about it because of this in vitro fertilization, where you take the eggs and you fertilize them and you get rid of the ones that you don't want to actually bring to fullness of birth. And what they can do when they're doing it at that stage, they can select for certain traits. They can use the eggs with the certain genes that they would know, for instance, are associated with intelligence. And that's why they're talking about this, because they can tend to do physical things like physical traits. But there is a complication with this, because you might have the genes that are responsible for, say, blue eyes, and they might also be responsible for something to do with intelligence. They might also be responsible for something to do with the way that the digestive system works, because you're limited with genes, with the code that they use. I think it's four letters, something like that, and certain genes may not just be responsible for one isolated thing. It may be a collection of genes, and that is responsible for the trait that you're actually looking for. So there could be problems with this, and then you've also got aspects of cloning that comes into this as well. When they cloned Dolly the sheep, and obviously that technology has advanced since then. So it's really about this in vitro fertilization now. And also, I mean, we may end up having to do that, because sperm counts have dropped by, I think, 40% in the last 40 years. Testosterone has dropped by 20% in the last 20 years. If that continues in the way that it's going, in 50 years' time, we may no longer have sperm that is capable of fertilizing a female egg in the natural way. It may have to be done by these in vitro fertilization. And obviously the reasons for that would be the subject of another podcast. But it does look as if this IVF is the way that things are going. And if you're doing IVF, then the idea is that you can enhance certain traits, or you can select for certain traits, and you can obviously deselect other traits that you don't want. So this is now possible to do. And obviously, it's going to be done in those parts of the world where they don't have such strict laws as we do in the West, such as in China. So there is an argument that the West needs to find out about this. The West needs to be doing this in order to keep up with China, who are already doing some things in this part of science that we're not able to do over here in Europe. Any thoughts on this, Max? Modern eugenics?
Yeah, what's been identified there as modern eugenics is really what I suppose a number of processes that involve a degree of surgical intervention. Genetics in the past has tended to revolve around selective breeding, whether that selective breeding is as a result of natural selection or whether it's as a result of livestock breeders selecting the traits that they felt are most desirable amongst their livestock. So applying that and people then deciding, well, if it works with farm animals, it ought to work with humans as well. And so therefore, we ought to look into this selective breeding of humans and to encourage people with the most desirable traits to have more children, and people with the less desirable traits or potentially harmful traits to have less children. And so that's if we then compare that with surgical interventions, which can include cloning and splicing, and for the moment, I just can't remember what the process is behind the COVID-19 vaccine. But there's again another method of genetic engineering that was employed there in order to create greater resistance to COVID-19. And the main difference between the two really is that there is a technical gulf between
CRISPR technology is the technology that's used for CRISPR, the COVID vaccine, and right, it's mRNA is what they're doing, modifying RNA, and the RNA directs the DNA. If that helps you out there, Max, CRISPR and mRNA.
Okay, so there is a clear divide then between eugenics as was practiced in the past, which, as I say, entirely revolved around breeding, and where there is a perception nowadays that that is linked to Nazi ideology, and the surgical interventions that are regarded as being something entirely separate that have developed in recent years since the mapping of the human genome. And I think the mapping of the human genome does open up a tremendous scope for there to be that kind of intervention in order to improve the lives of individual people. And again, this is another difference where the selective breeding ideas of the past tended to involve the mass of the public taking part in a selective breeding program, whereas the modern day eugenics tends to revolve around surgical interventions that are designed to bring relief to individual people who have inherited genes that create medical conditions that they don't want to have. And so I would say that they are the main differences. The problem that could be faced in the future, if we just follow the surgical intervention path, is that as each generation will go by, the children of people where there has been a surgical intervention will, unless the surgical intervention irrevocably changes the sperm and the egg produced by those people in the creation of future generations, what will happen is that as each generation comes into life, there will need to be a whole load of surgical interventions carried out on the babies concerned in order to put them in the same health category as their parents. It's a bit like if you can imagine a computer where you bring out a computer is created, it's got Windows 1, and then if in order for the children of that computer to have Windows 1, you can't just have one update which creates the different. Well, you can create have an update which creates the upgrading from Windows 1 to Windows 2. If you can imagine computers having sexually reproducing, for example, the next generation of computers wouldn't automatically come along with Windows 2 in them. They'd come along with Windows 1, and then you'd have to upload Windows 2. And then with the next generation, it'd come along with Windows 1, and you'd have to upload Windows 2, Windows 3, and it would be the Windows 2, 3, and 4, the next generation, etc. Unless the Windows upgrade meant that should the computers, and I appreciate this is requiring a certain amount of goodwill on the part of the listener, unless the upgrade to Windows creates a permanent upgrade that is inherited in future generations, there is going to be this slow accumulation of surgical interventions that all have going to have to be done in order to put the a new baby into the same state of genetic health as its parents were.
Yeah, I think that's one of the things that the ethics committees are talking about. I think that's one of the things that they can't do in the West, is to alter the genes in the germ line so that it couldn't actually then be passed on to the descendant. And obviously, what you're saying there is, because of that, each time you would have a child would be born, they didn't have to surgically intervene. You know, that CRISPR technology that they're using with this mRNA, they're saying they can pretty much do anything with that to somebody that is already alive. But then, would that then be passed on to their descendants? And of course, this is the worry that there is, that something could be introduced into the general population that we don't want to be there. But at the same time, you've got less of these laws governing what's done in this field of technology in China. So it's like the science has completely outpaced, you know, this idea of eugenics. And while the left and the progressives have all been concentrating on eugenics, and we can't possibly have that, we can't possibly have selective breeding, and the scientists have just bypassed that entirely and moved on to the next stage of changing the genetics directly, and then you're going to end up with the possibility of whoever's got the most money can afford to purchase, you know, the most intelligent or the most fit baby, and then you know, and then effectively to have that child implanted into somebody else's womb as well, so that you know, the mother's not actually having to take any risk, all sorts of things that were never thought about originally when they you know, when they were talking about eugenics, I think. Do you want to say something there, Max?
Yeah, you also have the issue of superbugs. You know, every so often we get warned that various antibiotics are being overused, and that those antibiotics, because they're being overused, are losing their ability to prevent infection, and that there are evolving these superbugs that have got immunity to the antibiotics. And the point is that you could end up with a future generation where the children being born in the children being born in that that generation would all need to have, let's say, I don't know, a dozen surgical interventions with regard to their genetic composition in order to bring them up to the genetic level of their parents, the standard of genetic health of their parents. And yet it may not be possible to perform a surgical intervention because there is a superbug around to which there is no there is no antibiotic that will kill it. And then you're in a situation where a community of people who have practiced eugenics as a result of breeding in the way that was originally envisaged in the early part of the last century would then have an advantage, because the selective advantages that they would have received would be passed on through the process of sexual reproduction, whereas a population of people who rely upon surgical interventions in order to upgrade all future generations, they could find themselves in a situation where they're unable to do that without risking mass infections and the deaths of their babies.
Yeah, the natural way is always going to be the best way, but as we're saying, you know, you've got the sperm counts, which keep decreasing. We have got an instance, a modern instance of a eugenics policy, and this is a particularly interesting one. It's in Singapore, and it was thought up by Lee Kuan Yew, who is often referred to as a benevolent dictator. He's sort of been the president for decades, basically, in Singapore. So we've just got the list of quotes from Wikipedia about Lee Kuan Yew and his eugenics policy here. Alarmed that Singapore's fertility rate was falling precipitously low, Lee launched the Graduate Mothers Scheme in 1983, giving tax deductions for children to women with university degrees and priority in admission to primary schools to graduate mothers with three or more children. In his speech at the 1983 National Day Rally, Lee said, "If you don't include your women graduates in your breeding pool and you leave them on the shelf, you would end up a more stupid society. So what happens? There will be less bright people to support dumb people in the next generation. And that is a problem. If we continue to respond ourselves in this lopsided manner, we will be unable to maintain our present standards," he added. "Levels of competence will decline. Our economy will falter. The administration will suffer and society will decline. For every two college graduates in 25 years' time, there will be one graduate, and for every two uneducated workers, there will be three." In June 1984, Lee's government rolled out grants for low-income and low-education women to undergo sterilisation. If a woman and her husband had no O-level passes and fewer than three children, the woman could receive $10,000 in a grant for undergoing sterilisation. Sterilised lower-class parents were also given priority primary school admission for their existing first and second children. The uproar over the proposal led to a swing of 12.9% against the People's Action Party in the general election held later that year. In 1985, especially controversial portions of the policy that gave education and housing priorities to educated women were eventually abandoned or modified. A proponent of nature over nurture, Lee averred that intelligence is 80% nature and 20% nurture, and he attributed the success of his children to genetics. Now, all of this is very interesting because Singapore, I think, has the highest IQ in the world, the highest average IQ. And I was looking at this and I was thinking, well, this might explain what has such a high IQ, because they did actually have a eugenics policy for a few years. And the brightest people were encouraged to breed and the less bright people were encouraged to accept sterilization. And another point that I was looking at this and it was making me think of is, well, he's giving these incentives to people with universities by saying that you will have these incentives, you'll get these tax deductions. And it reminded me of what we've got going on in Hungary. They're giving out tax deductions for mothers. You don't have to pay any tax at all up to the age of 30, just for breeding. And it made me think, we're at the stage now, forget about the eugenics policies, just actually getting white people to breed is that difficult that we have to bring in these tax deductions for them. And that is just so sad, isn't it? That literally just to get people to breed. I mean, years ago, you would give tax deductions to get the brightest people to breed, but now you give these tax deductions just to get anybody white to breed, because it is so difficult. So there's two points there. The fact that Singapore does have such a high IQ, and also, these tax deductions that Lee Kuan Yew was doing here for the Singaporeans, and that we see Viktor Orban doing for the Hungarians. You were telling me, Max, that there might be another reason for this high IQ over there in Singapore.
It won't necessarily be the reason that outweighs the reason you've just given. It might be that it just creates another factor in the equation, which we could consider as well. And this is based upon books that certainly include the writings of Richard Lynn. One of the things that I've identified there is that where there has been intelligence testing in a number of key gateway cities between the Far East and the West, and by that I mean Singapore, Hong Kong, but also Seoul in South Korea, there has been that the IQs in those places have been measured to be significantly higher than the IQ average around the world. And the evolutionary psychologists or whatever that have done this analysis, what they've actually come up with is that where you've had these Far Eastern countries turn to communism in the immediate aftermath of the Second World War, there was a tendency for the communist revolutionaries to, once they've gained power, to go through the country and systematically slaughter all the people who were regarded as being middle class or upper class or businessmen, all the people probably that had got the highest IQs in those countries, and that a very disproportionately large number of people who fell into that category fled those countries and fled to the gateway cities so that they could gain access to the West, and that has resulted in those three centres in the Far East having a significantly higher IQ than is the average.
So you've got more intelligent people there because they're the ones that managed to flee communism. There's also, I mean, I've always looked at this before and I thought, well, there's a lot of European expats in Singapore, a lot of Americans, a lot of British, lots of Europeans. And I thought maybe it was that was raising this IQ. But if it's also very high in Seoul and in Hong Kong, then it's not the Europeans that are actually boosting this IQ. And I do think Lee Kuan Yew was correct when he said that intelligence is 80% nature and 20% nurture. And I think that's been borne out by all the studies that they do. I mean, if you have a look at Professor Edward Dutton's books, that's about the ratio that he talks about as being borne out by all these different studies and tests that they do with this. And it just seems common sense to me. I mean, by the time you get to 40, you look in the mirror, you look just like your father, and you're behaving just like your father as well. It doesn't matter what your education was like, you do end up turning into your parents. And I think you can extend from that. By the time you get to 40, you become a representation of your race and your ethnicity, and all those hereditary influences that you have from all of your ancestors, they take over from the nurture. Continuing with these notes here that we've got from Wikipedia. In October 2015, the United Nations International Bioethics Committee wrote that the ethical problems of human genetic engineering should not be confused with the ethical problems of the 20th century eugenics movements. However, it is still problematic because it challenges the idea of human equality and it opens up new forms of discrimination and stigmatization for those who do not want or who cannot afford the technology. So interesting here, obviously the United Nations are behind this. They're encouraging this. The UN are encouraging these leaps forward with genetic engineering. And they don't want people to link it with eugenics. But it is, you know, it's a similar effect, isn't it? But it's just that this is not the natural way of doing it. The National Human Genome Research Institute, however, says that eugenics is inaccurate, scientifically erroneous, and immoral. And the National Human Genome Research Institute is literally banning researchers from having access to its information if what they are doing is research into things like intelligence. Any research that will show that there is a difference between ethnicities, a measurable difference, and that's what these professors want to study, the Human Genome Research Institute will not let them have the access to the information. And that information there is supposed to be publicly available. I mean, that's why it was collected. It was supposed to be there to help us to advance science. And what they're doing is they're actually retarding science. They're preventing it from actually being able to go where it wants to go, because it will show results which are not politically correct. I mean, it's really sad that is going on there, that they're actually preventing this research from being done. So it's interesting that the UN obviously wants this genetic engineering, and the Human Genome Research Institute is just preventing people from investigating these differences here. Any thoughts on that, Max?
Well, it would appear that that there is support for genetic engineering where that genetic engineering is intended to prevent a disease or a malady in children that are born, but using genetic engineering to improve the quality of as yet unborn children is what is being regarded as being immoral. which I think is wrong. I think it's both of those things should be regarded as important. But the point is that the political atmosphere within the world at the moment is one in which those sort of ideas are tending to hold sway. But the greater danger also comes from the sort of woke ideas that we should make our society we should not only model it so that it is just as easy for somebody who has got a kind of genetic disability or whatever to lead a full life, but that we should celebrate the malady that the person has who's inherited genes that create medical conditions and maladies that people don't really want to have. And so if the drift towards the woke end of human politics and philosophy continues, we could end up in a situation where eugenics entirely fizzles out, or where eugenics is then perverted to actually create and enable people who've got any kind of genetic defect for them to actually have greater advantages in life than people that were born without such defects, which would be a sort of a calamitous turning of genetics on its head.
The other thing is, like, if they're going to this National Human Genome Research Institute and they're looking for the genes which correspond with intelligence, and then they find that, you know, it's the European ethnicity and has very high amount of genes related for this intelligence. They'll also find that Ashkenazi Jews are slightly higher and South Asians are slightly higher as well. But then they'll discover that Black Africans are 30 points lower than the average of the Europeans. So if they were looking at this, trying to work out what are these genes that are there for intelligence, and then they started trying to use them, you would end up with people, they would no longer be black, would they? They would end up being half black and half white. Or it may be that those genes work differently when interacting with the other genes of black people. We know that the same gene that actually gives black people the colour to their skin, in white people, it gives them freckles. So it may be that if they did try to do this, say try to theoretically to raise the intelligence level of a race which has a lower than average intelligence, it may end up having all these unforeseen circumstances. It may not actually do what it is that they're expecting it to do. I do think that the best way to do this is just to have breed within your own group, and those that have the most desirable traits should be encouraged to breed, as you point out, Max, and those with the least desirable in traits encouraged to breed slightly less. And then over time, things would improve for everybody. And I think that is far preferable to messing around with things in a petri dish where you just don't know what the outcome of this is going to be. Well, moving on, transhumanism is often associated with eugenics, although most transhumanists, holding similar views nonetheless, distance themselves from the term eugenics, preferring germinal choice or reprogenetics to avoid having their position confused with the so-called discredited theories and practices of early 20th century eugenic movements. I suppose they say they're discredited, but they haven't actually been proved wrong. They have been smeared by being associated with Germany during the Second World War. And what they mean here by germinal choice or reprogenetics, that's basically IVF, and then selecting the most viable fertilized egg and disposing of the other fertilized eggs. So they're actually already taking a choice, making like a guess of that's going to be the one with obviously with the most desirable characteristics. So we'll get rid of these other ones. So they are already doing this. So it ends up with the same result as you would get with eugenics, but doing it in a completely different way. So transhumanists aren't actually calling it eugenics. And I think they're right there. I don't think they should be calling it eugenics, because eugenics you know, it is associated with natural breeding. Prenatal screening has been called by some a contemporary form of eugenics because it may lead to abortions of fetuses with undesirable traits. And why wouldn't you want people to be born into a healthy body with a healthy mind to start out with the very best resources? Why would you want somebody to be born with Down syndrome, for instance? Yes, Down syndrome people are very likable when they're young. As they get older, they become very difficult to deal with. They're more susceptible to disease, and they're not really productive members of society. They don't really contribute to society, and they're not able to fully live the life of a human being because, you know, they have these congenital problems. So why wouldn't you want to screen for things like this? And this is the argument that they have. Of course, you get these parents of Down syndrome children, and they'll say, well, this is terrible. They shouldn't be doing away with these fetuses, that they should be allowed to be born. And there was actually a case where this Down syndrome girl took the government to court over this, over them actually doing this, because she said, you know, that they were basically allowing people to exterminate herself. Obviously, she wouldn't have the intelligence to actually do this, but she did take the government to court over it, and they said, no, you know, we need to do this because it's for the good of the larger group, effectively. So, you know, this has actually come to court, and they came down on the side of doing what's best for the group, rather than being concerned about this individual's feelings. So that is one instance of this. And finally, a system was proposed by California State Senator Nancy Skinner to compensate victims of the well-documented examples of prison sterilizations resulting from California's eugenics programs, but this did not pass by the bill's 2018 deadline in the legislature. So this brings up the fact that habitual criminals were forced to be sterilized many years ago in America, but that sort of thing also went on in Japan. It went on in lots of countries, and we would never talk about or encourage, you know, forced sterilization, but encourage sterilization of people that had these less desirable traits, in the same way that Lee Kuan Yew did in Singapore. So any thoughts on this, Max? Transhumanism, prenatal screening, Down syndrome, all of this sort of stuff?
Well, transhumanism, from what I've read of transhumanism, is largely a body of people who are looking forward to a time when humans can be made immortal by transferring the human mind into a machine that can therefore be maintained in perpetuity. And so it all revolves, in my view, around immortality, but also of the development of machinery, which together with some human parts, so creating something which would be regarded presumably as a cyborg, you have something which is half man, half machine. I can remember listening to a radio program some years ago where they were talking about the American Army developing an exoskeleton that soldiers could wear, which would enable them to, which would not only protect their body, but which would enable them to run much faster than a man could normally run, and would enable them to go for like several days without having to stop for food or sleep and things of this sort. And so, you know, there are scientists around the world that are working on these kind of projects. The problem that you have, though, with this type of thing is that machines and machine code works on the basis of strict logic. Machine code doesn't operate on an illogical or an emotional basis, and it will just conduct calculations based upon algorithms in order to find the logical answer, in order to determine how it behaves. And there was it was interesting. I can't remember what the name of this particular bot was, but my understanding is that Microsoft developed a bot several years ago, which was active on the internet, so that when people made it could interact with other people on the internet, but it was an entirely a robot type of phenomenon, and because it was programmed as a result of machine code, and it was programmed such that it would use logic in order to determine how it behaves, it developed and developed a degree of an ability to respond to other people. And so almost it was almost what the sort of acme of artificial intelligence that people sort of sometimes fantasize about, but or certainly you know, several steps along the way towards developing that type of thing. But the problem was that after operating for a certain period of time, I can't remember again how long it was because it's a while back since I read this, but the bot started to behave racist. It made decisions about people based upon their race. I have read articles written by people who've suggested that effectively closes off the avenue of transhumanism from people who are of a woke like mind, a woke mindset, because of the need for computer systems to work on the basis of logic and for machine code to operate on the basis of logic, it will always logically analyze the people that it comes into contact with and will make decisions about how sensible or how reliable the information or the views that those people are have that that it encounters. As we've already discussed in many of our conversations, because nationalism and having a belief that race matters is a matter of pure logic, it means that all transhuman systems and all pure AI systems in future will ultimately become racist.
Yeah, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, they've realised this. So what they're doing is they're introducing defects into these things. I mean, we can already see it with Google search, where instead of just finding the most popular article, if the most popular article is a politically incorrect one, that'll get moved down to the bottom of the results. And this has effectively broken the Google search engine. I mean, it just doesn't function anymore in the way that it should function. And artificial intelligence program you were talking about there was TAI, T-A-I, and it was on Twitter and elsewhere, and they introduced it, and within 3 months it had basically turned into a racist, if you want to call it that. And that was just based on all these interactions. So what they try to do with the AI now is they try to politically correct it, which of course means to introduce errors to the functioning. And when you think about this link with transhumanism, particularly Elon Musk's Neuralink, where he basically linked up a monkey with a computer and the monkey could play games with its mind without having to use its hands. So if you're literally going to link people up with these computers, and then you've got the computer has already been broken and politically corrected, then you're going to be introducing all these defects as well. And when you think about the number of updates that you have to have for Windows to be linked up with a computer, you're going to keep having to have all these updates, and it's going to be introducing all these errors because it can't function on logic, because logic tells you that race is real and it's pretty central to everything. So yeah, you could end up with all sorts of problems on the way of linking up man with machines. I mean, the most important thing really to do is to get our sperm levels back up and do things naturally, and just have selective breeding, just do things in the natural, normal way that it was done for thousands of years. Instead of thinking that we can improve upon nature, we should be working with nature in the way that that we do with animals and plants, basically, and we should be applying that to humans. Well, I think we should probably leave that here for today, Max. And you got any final thoughts on eugenics at all before we finish?
No, apart from just saying that I broadly agree with what you've just said, although that may be an emotional, from an emotional standpoint rather than from a purely logical standpoint. But there we are. I don't know. Yeah, I'm human, aren't I?
Yeah, well, it's also a nationalist viewpoint, I think, that most nationalists have. So thank you very much for coming on today, Max.
That's my pleasure.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with more Real Britannia for you. And, of course, we do hope you have a great week ahead of you.